From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the little-told story of the Miller Park sales tax and the governmental body that collects it.
They owned about two-thirds of Miller Park, and what ends up happening is that there hasn't been a particularly intense amount of scrutiny of what this money actually gets spent for.
Plus, forget about Jesse Owens for a moment, we'll learn about the other compelling American story at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. And the rush of discovering rare 78 RPM records and the stories behind them.
And there's something really fun and I think exciting about the mystery of so much of this music and how undiscovered it feels and how you can really find a record. And, you know, particularly with some of these records being so rare, you can find a record. It may be the only known copy of a thing, which is almost hard for us to conceive of now.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. The new owners of the Milwaukee Bucks say it's imperative for the city to have a plan in place by the new year for how to replace the BMO Harris Bradley Center. They and other advocates of a new arena say the Bucks' home since the late 80s has become outdated and unsuitable for a 21st century pro sports franchise. Even with sizable contributions from the new owners and past owner Herb Cole, the project is likely to seek public money as well. And that has many thinking back, both positively and negatively, to the tax to support the construction of Miller Park. It's a tax that's still being collected, even long after the baseball stadium's construction was complete. What that tax does today is the topic of a feature in the September issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Matt Rohde wrote that piece, and he's with us in the Lake Effect studio to share more. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks. Glad to be here.
Let me ask you about the first line in the story. You write, "The good thing about Miller Park is how well maintained it is, and the bad thing about Miller Park is how well maintained it is." I will be honest in saying that as a non-native Milwaukeean, my only experience with the old county stadium was a trip there to see a Brewers-Tigers series back in the 90s, and it was not very well maintained at that point. So how is Miller Park's good maintenance a double-edged sword?
Oh, you mentioned county stadium, and it was pretty dilapidated but near the end of its life to the point where it wasn't even meeting building codes. And community leaders and state legislators didn't want to have this happen again at some point with Miller Park. So when the tax was passed, which ended up being a 0.1% sales tax in southeast Wisconsin, they set up a system where a certain amount of money would be put into what's called a segregated reserve fund. And then that money is used for maintenance and also what's described as discretionary projects under the lease between the Brewers and the stadium district.
And the stadium district is essentially the landlord in this equation.
Right, right. They owned about two-thirds of Miller Park. And what ends up happening is that there hasn't been a particularly intense amount of scrutiny of what this money actually gets spent for. And so it's been spent for some projects that have been arguably unnecessary, such as we've found an instance where they had spent money it was about $39,900 on floor insulation for the Brewers Club offices where the executives have offices. And these are cantilevered out over the seating bowl as if this was an indoor facility, but it's very much still an outdoor facility within the seating bowl. So in the winter, it gets very cold, and some of this money that was set aside from the tax money coming in each year was spent – 1 year to put insulation in. So it's quite a lot of money. I mean, $26 million in sales taxes come to the district every year.
Right, right. So maybe let's go through a quick primer on the stadium tax. What is the authority that collects it?
It's called the Southeast Wisconsin Professional Baseball Park District, and it was created by the state legislature in the mid-90s with this authority to levy a sales tax. And so the State Department of Revenue collects the money and then disperses it to the district every year. And they have pretty wide discretion to spend it as they want to. And there's a board that oversees it. And they approve a budget each year. And then they approve a plan, spending plan for this segregated reserve fund, which serves as a maintenance and improvement fund.
And as you were talking about before, the idea here is that if the public was going to put a lot of money into building this, they didn't want to be in a position where it would get built and then would systematically start falling apart again the way, as you say, County Stadium did towards the end.
Right. That was the intention. From what we found, it appears that so much money has been spent on maintenance and discretionary projects and other improvements that it's gone a ways beyond preventing another County Stadium and into the headline of the piece was The Palace, which is kind of a grabby headline, but it really seems that so many different improvements have been made that this has gone beyond a simple baseball stadium.
This has become the anti-County Stadium.
Right, right. This is about as far from County Stadium as you can get. We found one project where they had spent a number of thousands of dollars on studying putting a one-way mirror in the center of the outfield that would be non-reflective and one-way, obviously, so that batters wouldn't be distracted, or fans could go to this area and watch the on-field action from a unique vantage point. But they couldn't find the right form of glass for this, even though other stadiums seem to have been successful. And
this is, of course, where the rub is. There are some who say that these are costs that the Brewers themselves should bear. Is there an argument? Did the stadium district talk or the stadium tax district talk about why they believe the public ought to finance things like new scoreboards?
They see themselves as the landlord, and they see themselves as the primary owner of Miller Park. And so they view their relationship speaking to me, they likened it to the relationship between an apartment tenant and a landlord, that they, in most cases, if it involves substantial improvement and not some kind of everyday wear and tear, or if it's a major repair or capital improvement, then the bulk of the responsibility should fall to them. The Brewers make a small contribution each year to the segregated reserve fund that's roughly in keeping with how much they own in the stadium. So they are sharing in the burden in that way. But mostly the district is of the opinion that they're actually being good stewards of tax dollars and at times holding the Brewers accountable for performing routine maintenance. And they frequently deny requests that the Brewers have made for projects to use money from the segregated reserve fund. And so they say that they've been responsible with the money that's coming in.
And at the heart of this, I'm guessing the aim is to make the Brewers happy enough, though, that they re-up their lease.
Right, right. It's up for renewal in 2030. There's a possibility for a 10-year extension to 2040. And I sense a certain amount of anxiety of the district sees itself as also bearing the responsibility of being good partners with the Brewers so that they want to stay in town and to keep them happy. So I think that's part of what's going on.
Who oversees the tax district?
There's a board of, 13 people, and it's sort of a potpourri of there's a sports lawyer, sports business lawyer on there. A few people who are just somewhat well-connected politically, have a background. Don Smiley, the CEO of Summerfest, is the chair, and he's a former president of the Florida Marlins, so he has a baseball background. And they meet on a regular basis and go over the budget and what the SRF spending plan is going to be. So there's a certain amount of oversight in that sense. Those meetings aren't well attended. I believe the Journal Sentinel sends a reporter most of the time. They do more intensive stories when a big issue comes up, like spending. They spent $3.1 million on the LED ribbon board, sort of like a news ticker, and then the HD scoreboard, which ended up being almost $6 million.
And the point here is that this is a public body, so these are open meetings. Anybody could theoretically go to them.
Right, right. And that may start to happen more. Legislators, especially in Racine County, have sort of gotten a burr under their saddle about this.
In a bipartisan way. You write about Corey Mason and Thomas Weatherston, who are Democrat and Republican, respectively. What are they hoping to accomplish?
They would like to opt Racine County out of the taxing district. There's a possibility of perhaps at some point another audit by the Legislative Audit Bureau. The one that happened in 2002 was quite contentious. And actually the most contentious one that I've ever read. And there's actually a letter from the state auditor at the time apologizing for how fractured the process had become, and that the district board and the board chair at the time wasn't smiley at that time, had penned such a scathing rebuttal that it called into question the very existence of the audit bureau. So we could end up going down that road again. Possibly.
Something to look forward to.
Right. I don't know if it would be quite as contentious this time.
And in fact, you're right that Thomas Weatherston wasn't very optimistic about this gaining a lot of traction statewide.
It's always been the story of the stadium tax is it's authorized by the state, but most of the people who are voting for or against it don't live in the affected area.
And frankly, if you live in La Crosse or Eau Claire and you come to, a series of games, you're probably happy that the place
right.
looks nice.
You got your they got their money's worth.
At the same time, you write that some might look at this as a financing model for a downtown arena district.
Right. And there's still talk happening now about some kind of public funding source to build a replacement for the Bradley Center. And so this would be the most obvious model. Corey Mason was of the opinion that Miller Park had in some way salted the ground for this to happen again because they weren't more austere in how they were dealing with the money that came in, and the tax has kind of gone on and on.
Well, right. Originally, the tax was supposed to sunset, I believe, next year. What's the likely – first of all, you write that that's not going to happen next year. What do experts say is likely to be the date for when this tax actually goes away?
Right now, it could take as long as 2021. Most – they expected and the stadium district was told to expect about a 5.5% yearly increase in the amount of money. But then that sort of didn't happen, and then there was a recession, and then they claim that the bond market hasn't been particularly favorable either. So the debt has kind of hung around. In the meantime, they've been putting aside quite a lot of money so that they can continue funding the segregated reserve fund for maintenance and improvements even after the tax has sunsetted. And they just described to me pushing it even to 2040 so that they have enough money sort of socked away in case the Brewers extend the lease for another 10 years. And they told me we're trying to make this stadium last for 40 years for professional baseball was the quote.
And at the end of the day, the floors in the front office are probably somewhat warmer now.
Right, right. Yes, Tootsies are cozy.
Matt Rohde, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Rohde is associate editor at Milwaukee Magazine. His article on the Miller Park sales tax is in the September issue of the magazine. You'll find a link from WUWM.com/lakeeffect. A short break now, and in just a moment, the story of a remarkable gold medal-winning American rowing team nearly 80 years ago. It's Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Yesterday on the show, we learned about when competitive walking was the most popular spectator sport in this country. That time was the late 19th century. It was supplanted by a variety of other popular sports, first bicycle racing, then baseball, football, and rowing. Later this month, some of the top rowers in the country will descend on Wisconsin for the annual Milwaukee River Challenge. It'll draw throngs of curious onlookers, but back in 1936, rowing was very much in the public consciousness at large. It was in that year that an underdog group of American rowers took on the world's best at the Olympics in Berlin and took home a gold medal. That story of the college rowers from the University of Washington is told in Daniel James Brown's best-selling book, The Boys in the Boat, a book that's been favorably compared to other sports histories like Laura Hillenbrand's Seabiscuit. Daniel James Brown joined us in the studio recently to tell the story. Great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I wanted to start by having you share the story of how this book started, how the story ended up in your own consciousness. You were not a rowing writer.
No, I didn't know anything about rowing at all when I started this. The story just walked into my life one day about 6 years ago. We have these horrible homeowners association meetings in my neighborhood. And after one of those, one of my neighbors, a lady I knew only as Judy, came up to me and she said she'd been reading one of my earlier books to her dad. And her dad was living under hospice care at her home in the last couple months of his life. And he was enjoying that book, so she wondered if I'd come down and meet him. So, of course, I went down. I think it was the next day. And I met this very elderly gentleman named Joe Rance. And we talked just briefly about that earlier book. But then he began to talk about his childhood experiences growing up during the Depression. And he had a very poignant story to tell about his family's situation in the Depression. And that was very affecting. And that actually became a very important part of the book. But then he began to talk about how he came to the University of Washington in 1933 and began to row, and how he became a part of this crew that ultimately went to Berlin in 1936 and wound up rowing for a gold medal there against a German boat in front of Hitler. And it was just, I became absolutely mesmerized by the story as he was telling it.
Did you have any skepticism when you – because, you know, there are people who spin a good yarn and then it turns out that they play just a minor role in something.
I wasn't skeptical about Joe's role because Joe was actually tearing up a lot as he was telling this, and his daughter Judy had spent many years collecting the story. So I was confident about that, but I was nervous. I knew I was going to have to tell the story of all nine young men that were in Berlin that summer. And I didn't know, you know, I didn't know what they would turn out to be like. He might have been in a boat with eight jerks for all I knew. And I was very fortunate because as I got to know the other, what had been young men through their families mostly, I found out they really were a great bunch of guys. And every one of them was remarkable and they all had interesting backstories. So it turned out to work out all right.
Right. I wonder if you had met one of the other members of the team in the same way, maybe, you know, Roger Morris or any of them, would their stories have been equally as compelling as Joe Rance?
Well, you know, I do think it was a fortunate circumstance that I ran into Joe. I met Joe first. Although they all have interesting backstories, I think Joe's is particularly affecting and also kind of revealing of the times in certain ways. And so I don't know, you know, if I had met Roger first, he had an interesting story too. But Joe's was really so compelling that that was the real impetus for me to dive into it and start basically the day after I met Joe Rance working on this book.
And as you say, a key part of Joe Rance agreeing to tell the story, though, was that he wanted to be sure it was about the boat, that is, the guys in the boat.
Exactly. In fact, that first day that I met him at the end of this conversation, I said, I put it the wrong way. I said, Joe, can I write a book about your life? And he shook his head and he said, no, I don't want you to write a book about my life. And then he thought for a minute and he said, But you could write a book about the boat. And by the boat, of course, he meant these nine young men, but he also meant this sort of almost perfect thing that they had all become together that summer, 75 years before in Berlin.
Well, so if you weren't necessarily a rowing writer, Joe Rance was not necessarily, not at all, from a rowing pedigree, and the Pacific Northwest wasn't really the center of the rowing universe. Who were the top rowers in the world, and where did rowing most thrive at this point?
The center of rowing still was largely in the East, in the Ivy League schools, where it had been for many, many decades. And the boys from the Ivy League schools were mostly kids who were privileged in various ways. They were the sons of bankers or titans of industry. And that was really sort of the center of gravity for rowing, though the Wisconsin and the Midwest had some very fine crews. And then we're out in the West Coast. It was basically California and Washington as the two emerging powers. By the mid-1930s, the Western crews had begun to win some championships in the East. And so they were beginning to be taken seriously at the time that this story unfolds.
The University of Washington itself had not exactly a secret weapon, but certainly an ideal boat builder to kind of put them on the map.
Yeah, sort of almost their secret weapon was this interesting character named George Yeoman Pocock. And Pocock was a British-born boat builder. He had grown up in the shell house at Eton College, building boats, apprenticed to his father, building racing shells. He wound up in Seattle building these beautiful handcrafted cedar shells, originally for the University of Washington. And by the mid-1930s, he was building them for every collegiate crew in the country. And he's a fascinating guy because in addition to being a boat builder, he was a very fine oarsman. And more than that, he was sort of a sage-like figure. He was very wise, and he was also something of a spiritual mentor for these boys. He gave them a sense of having a higher purpose when they rowed, and that became a very important part of what made this crew work.
He also wrote clearly at length about rowing, and your chapters start with a little epigram from him.
Yeah, I mean, the words of Pocock, there's so much wisdom in the various things he said that we decided early on that we would begin each chapter with one of these quotes from his various sayings, which were taken from a variety of different sources, from books about him. And his son, Stan, gave me access to his father's papers. And one of the quotes actually comes from a note that was wrapped around an oar that he shipped over to an Olympic team in Europe one year. So, yeah, I mean, I think those quotes help infuse the book and the story with sort of the spirit of Pocock.
We've sort of alluded to it, but not really told this story. Joe Rantz did not have an easy journey to be at the University of Washington.
No, I mean, he really had a very difficult, as I say, childhood situation to overcome. He wound up as a teenager basically living alone out in the on the Olympic Peninsula in a half-finished house and literally having to forage for berries and poach fish out of the Dungeness River in order to survive. And he had to go from that to being a success at the university. And it was an enormous uphill climb for him, both financially and also, you know, just psychologically to get to that point. And he was extraordinarily perseverant, and he just kept at it. And crew was the mechanism by which he was able to go to university. As long as he was able to stay on crew, he was promised a part-time job, and that was just enough to let him get by in Depression-era Seattle.
I think his resilience showed not just in the rest of his life but in crew as well. I mean, he could have easily given up in any of these realms of his life.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he had so many challenges, and crew was one of them. Crew is a very challenging sport. I mean, he was through this whole three-year saga, Joe was always in danger of being cut from crew and therefore of being unable to go to university and therefore being unable to marry Joyce, the girl he wanted to marry. And so there were those kinds of threats hanging over him throughout. And his whole life was a trial early on. And so the story is largely a story of perseverance, so that's also largely a story of trust. The problem that Joe had when he got to the university was because he had been abandoned, he basically grew up trusting no one. But crew is a sport that requires you to trust very deeply the other men or women that are in the boat with you. And so Joe's inability to trust others was a huge impediment for him to becoming the great oarsman that he was capable of ultimately becoming.
There's a parallel story that you tell of where rowing was internationally, especially as Germany prepared to host the 1936 Olympic Games. What was rowing to that effort?
Yeah, you know, at the Olympics, well, first of all, the 36 Olympics were themselves an enormous propaganda effort. And the design was, of course, to portray Germany as a modern, enlightened, progressive country. During that same period, all sorts of dark things were happening behind the scenes. And so rowing was actually one of the fields in which Germany had an opportunity to really excel. And in fact, the day of the gold medal race, which is the culmination of this story, leading up to this eight-oared race, Germany won the first five gold medals that day. And so when this American crew rowed out to the starting line for their gold medal race that day, Hitler and Goebbels and Goering were on a balcony watching. There were 75,000 mostly German fans there chanting Deutschland, 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 and Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil.
And the deck was kind of stacked based on where the lane selections were.
Yeah, very stacked. The Americans had turned in the fastest qualifying time of any of the crews. They were mysteriously assigned lane 6, which was out in the windiest, widest part of the race course. And Germany and Italy, the two fascist powers, were assigned lanes 1 and 2, the most protected lanes. And it gave them a tremendous advantage. And in fact, halfway through the race, 1,000 meters down the course, the Americans were dead last, out in the windiest, widest part of the race course, watching the Italians and the Germans streak down toward what appeared would be an inevitable victory.
We won't necessarily go any further from there, but anybody who reads the back cover knows that in the end, the Americans pull off a pretty amazing comeback.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you will know from the beginning that they win this race. That my intent was never to build suspense that way. But what is extraordinary is the second half, the second 1,000 meters of that race. They came from such a very desperate situation, and they had other problems. Their stroke oar was desperately ill, barely conscious, in fact. And they had gotten off to a terrible start because they didn't hear the start. So what's extraordinary is being out in the middle of that windy part of the course and coming back from the distance that they came back. They wound up winning by just 0.6 seconds, but they did win. And the last few hundred meters of that race are just absolutely extraordinary. And they were wonderfully fun to write about.
Why do you think this story is not better known? Is it because the dominant narrative of the 1936 games generally involves Jesse Owens?
Yeah, well, the Jesse Owens story, which is a great story, it did sort of suck all the oxygen out of the room in terms of press coverage that August, and it utterly dominated the headlines. So I think that's one factor. Another factor is that these boys didn't come back all in once to a big ticker tape parade in Seattle even. They came back in dribs and drabs. And because they were all struggling financially, they just basically stuck their gold medals in sock drawers and immediately went out and tried to find a job, some way to get through the next school year. The stories faded away even in Seattle to a large extent. Some of these guys never even mentioned to their kids that they had won gold medals. So the families have nurtured the story for quite a while. And I would say people of a certain age in Seattle do remember that it happened. But largely it got lost in other events that summer.
There's a very extensive author notes section of this book. And as I read through that section, it struck me just how excited it seemed the families were to finally get to tell this story to someone.
Yeah, it was wonderfully satisfying for me, actually. When Joe's family, I mean, Joe's family was the impetus that day I met Joe. But through Joe's daughter, Judy, the family members of the other 8 guys in the boat found out what I was doing pretty promptly. And as I say, they'd been sitting on the story for a long time. And they came to me with boxes of letters and diaries and news clippings. And more importantly, they sat down with me for many, many hours. I probably have 100 hours or more of recorded interviews with them as they told me their father or grandfather's story and backstory from those years. And so it was through the families mostly that I was able to get to know these guys. And it's been very, very gratifying to me that the families have all been so excited about the book.
Well, and in the end, you ended up with a famous rowing writer's press badge from the 1936 Olympics, which must have been just incredibly special.
Yeah, there's a very, in Seattle at least, a very famous sports writer named Royal Brome. And he was both a big booster of this American crew and also the journalist who traveled with them. And after the hardcover edition of the book came out, his granddaughter, Kathy Soriano, asked if she could meet me at a Starbucks. And she presented me with this little bronze press badge from her grandfather's time in Berlin. And that just was so sweet. It really made an impression on me.
What really strikes me as we read the epilogue is hearing about how these guys kept getting together for reunion rows in the same boat.
Yeah, as I say, crew is a sport that requires an enormous amount of mutual trust and respect. And these guys were so bonded together by that experience. And that's why Joe was tearing up, 75 years later. they were so bonded together that for the rest of their lives, they got their families together for backyard barbecues and swim parties and things like that. And they were just incredibly close. Even when they were very, very old men, they just were bonded together like brothers.
Have you found yourself in a boat?
Oh, only very briefly, only long enough to realize that it was kind of cute. When I was first doing this, the freshman coach at Washington took me out with the coaching launch, a motorboat, to watch the freshman boys row. And it was a windy, miserable day out on Lake Washington. And I was huddled down in the boat thinking about how miserable I was. And there was these eight big, buff, 20-year-old kids stripped down without shirts, rowing away and back and forth. And they were out there doing sprints for a couple hours. And then we came back to the shell house, and they sat down at the erg machines and began to pull at those. And I decided right then and there, I'm not going to get in a boat with these guys. No way.
The boat does still exist, though.
The boat still exists, and it's something of an icon at the University of Washington. It hangs in the crew shell house over the dining commons, and it's just a gorgeous thing to see. It's this beautiful burnished cedar shell with a yellow spruce trim, and the sunlight comes in and glints off of it. And actually, since the book has come out, Bob Ernst, the director of rowing at Washington, tells me there's been a steady stream of people coming through the shell house to look at the boat.
Well, you've done good. Daniel James Brown, thank you so much. It's a terrific book, and congratulations.
Thanks so much.
Daniel James Brown is the author of The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold in the 1936 Berlin Olympics. He spoke with us before a recent reading in Milwaukee. One last break, and then a recent book explores the world of 78 RPM record collectors and the historical and musical importance of those objects. We'll learn about it when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. If you are older than, say, 35, you have probably heard of the 78 RPM record, even if you haven't actually heard one. The 78's heyday was in the first half of the 20th century before they gave way to LPs and 45s and later 8-track tapes and cassettes and then CDs and MP3s. If you see 78s today, it's likely in a thrift store, a rummage sale, or maybe your grandparents' attic. But there are some who see great value in the 78, both for the audio it produces and for the artists whose work might be lost forever if not for the handful of copies of their songs that still exist. As we'll hear, many of those artists were recorded at a record company just north of Milwaukee. The scarcity of these records and the unique world of 78 collectors are the topic of a new book by New York writer Amanda Petrosich, who traveled from Key West to the Milwaukee River in search of the 78's allure. Her book is called Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. She joined us recently by phone from New York. Welcome to the show.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Help set this up for us a little. What makes the 78 RPM records that you write about, largely from the pre-war blues and the folk genre, what makes them so significant?
Well, because 78 RPM records are so fragile, and because nearly no metal masters have survived of those sessions, the 78 themselves, so the artifacts, the records, are sometimes the only evidence we have that these songs were ever written. And because the performances are so tremendous and the music is so beautiful, the idea of collectors kind of getting out in the field and working and fighting and sort of manically hunting down these performances, it all starts to feel very high stakes, kind of best kind of treasure hunt, because at the end of the day, the reward, if they find the record, we get these songs, we get the evidence that these things were being written, this art was being made, and I think it deepens and really enriches our understanding of early American music.
Do we even have a sense for what's out there? How well cataloged is this material?
It is so poorly cataloged, which in some ways is really the kind of tale of the ways in which particularly black musicians were sort of marginalized in the beginning of the recording industry, the commercial recording industry. Race records, as they were called then, which were you know, records that were made by African-American performers, largely for African-American audiences. Very poor records were kept, and if records were kept at all, very, very few have survived. So there's almost no evidence. I mean, for a few labels, there are a few things, but by and large, it's really hard. It's hard to know what's still out there. It's hard to know what's missing. It's hard to know what's left that hasn't been found yet.
So there are some holy grails out there that collectors are looking for, but then there are some holy grails that could exist that we don't even know about.
Absolutely. I mean, I spent so much time with collectors in the course of writing and reporting this book, and that was something I would hear from them over and over again, that so much of the joy of this was how undiscovered this music was, that you could find some record that would have a kind of weird-looking label on it by a band you'd never heard of, and you would put it on and it would change everything for you, that it was the kind of endless potential, to find something that was previously undiscovered or to hear something that would just be particularly moving to you. And that's kind of fun, I think, especially in 2014, in an era in which we have so much access and such easy access to so much music. It's so easy for us to contextualize it. You can kind of find out everything about an artist within a few minutes of hearing their song. You can be looking at their Instagram feed. You know what they ate for lunch. You know, you can look at their Wikipedia page. It's like all the information is there. And there's something really fun and I think exciting about the mystery of so much of this music and how undiscovered it feels and how you can really find a record. And, you know, particularly with some of these records being so rare, you can find a record. It may be the only known copy of a thing, which is almost hard for us to conceive of now.
Well, and one of the other things that struck me as I read this is that it seems that and you write about this, that the rarity is not just the object itself, but it's also the rare opportunity to hear the music in the form that it was created.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was, again, one of the really sort of tremendous joys for me of writing and reporting this book, was getting to hear these records. And people will talk about, you know, analog fidelity and the sort of warmth of listening to a vinyl LP versus an MP3. 78s are a little bit different because they don't sound great. I mean, they're crackly, they're old, they're often damaged in one way or another. It's almost impossible to find a mint copy of 78 from 1929, sort of by virtue of how much time has passed. And, of course, the recording technology was quite a bit more rudimentary, and the compound that 78s are made of, it's mostly shellac, but they would throw in all kinds of other stuff. So you have to work a little bit harder sometimes to sort of hear the melodies or hear the voices or hear the kind of different things that we search for when we put on a song. But there's something so rewarding about that. There's something, I think, for me, after a while of getting to listen to these records, getting to listen to these songs on 78, there was something I began to find incredibly intoxicating and beautiful about listening to those records that way, of really feeling like it was a document of a particular moment.
There is a song you describe listening to that we're actually going to have a chance to hear, and you describe your challenge in explaining what makes it such a transcendent experience. So I kind of feel bad for asking you to try in this venue. But what is it about Geechee Wiley's Last Kind Word Blues that has such an effect on you in particular?
Geechee Wiley is such an interesting figure in the whole of popular music because she's a bit of a cipher. There was, until very recently, we knew almost nothing about her. We knew that she played with a woman named Elvie Thomas and that they recorded a handful of sides for a label called Paramount Records, which is, of course, based in Grafton, Wisconsin, not far from Milwaukee. And that was really about it. All we had were those records and those names. We couldn't, you know, people didn't know where she was from or sort of, you know, where she had died or how she had made her way from Mississippi, which was the sort of vague sense of where she had probably come from, you know, all the way up to Wisconsin to record. And I think something about having that song, I mean, it's a tremendously beautiful, powerful, kind of odd and idiosyncratic sounding song, and her voice and her guitar playing are very powerful, but something about not being able to contextualize it, about this sort of voice and this melody just kind of springing forth from the ether, I think is very, very, it's a very ghostly experience to listen to it. And it also forces you to sort of provide your own context for it, given that there isn't, you know, a historical context for it. You're kind of pushed in a way, I think, to provide a personal context for it, to just sort of feel the things that art can make us feel, that music can make us feel.
The last kind word I hear in my dad say, not the last kind word I hear in my daddy say. If I die in the German war, I want to send my body, send it to my my mother-in-law.
You do write about the inherent contradiction between collecting and analyzing mainly pre-war blues music and the spirit of the music itself, which was carried out with this sort of lawless abandon. Did you have some concern that this pursuit and maybe the book itself ran the risk of wringing some of the appeal out of the music as you sought to explain it?
That's a great question. And yes, absolutely. I think I'm sort of working in constant fear of that, of really wanting to preserve. I felt the sort of circuitry that had kind of lit up in me when I first started listening to 78s. I became immediately very protective of that. And I could see a lot of the collectors that I was interviewing having these extraordinary and extreme reactions to this music and then immediately trying to mediate it, immediately trying to sort of explain it away, either by really aggressively contextualizing or historicizing or, you know, researching the records. And I really wanted to preserve it. I mean, for me, that was so much of the joy of this experience. And it was tricky. I mean, I do think knowing certain things about an artist or knowing certain things about the circumstances under which a record was made can be useful and can enhance one's experience of listening to it. But there was certainly part of me, again, that just felt very protective of that pathway. I wanted to keep having that sort of pure reaction to music that I felt was so missing in my experience of art otherwise. And it was tricky. It was a really tricky balance to kind of learn enough about the records that I felt like I could write about them in an authoritative and hopefully compelling way, but also to keep the experience really personal.
You mentioned Paramount Records, and Paramount plays a big role in this book, and I would guess there are some Wisconsinites who appreciate what was a local company back in the 20s and 30s and I think into the 40s. But for people who don't, what was the significance of Paramount in this world?
Paramount Records was operated out of Grafton, Wisconsin, and it was founded in the late 1910s by the Wisconsin Chair Company, which was based in nearby Port Washington. And they were generating phonograph cabinets, which at the time were thought of as pieces of furniture, and records were sold in furniture stores as like the thing you did with your, you know, cabinet. They were really secondary. It was the kind of dawn of the, you know, idea of commercial recordings and of the record industry. And Paramount Records began releasing, you know, local kind of Germanic pop music and other, you know, dance bands, sort of light classical and things like that. And it wasn't until the 20s when the company itself was floundering a bit. It was having a hard time staying afloat financially. And around then, OK Records had released a 78 by a blues singer named Mamie Smith called Crazy Blues. She was an African-American woman, and the record was a huge hit. It sold a ton of copies, and somebody at Paramount Records thought, okay, maybe this is a way to make some money, and they launched their Race Records series. And from then on, they sort of accidentally ended up recording these titans of blues music. I mean, folks like Charlie Patton and Skip James and Blind Lemon Jefferson and Geechee Wiley, who we were speaking about earlier. And it was just a very sort of strange and unlikely story that this kind of small label in, you know, Wisconsin was recording all these incredible singers, mostly from, you know, the Mississippi Delta or sort of surrounding environs, that were being brought up by train and, you know, spending a day or two in Wisconsin and recording either in the studio in Grafton or in Chicago. Unfortunately, it wasn't quite enough to save the business. And when the pressing plant shut down, when the label shut down, all of their metal masters were either melted down in the war effort or destroyed for other reasons. And disgruntled employees, apparently, as legend goes, were just sort of hurling, you know, frisbeeing 78s into the Milwaukee River because they were angry that they had just lost their jobs. So much of the kind of dead stock of 78s had been lost in that way. The masters were gone. It seemed like, you know, Paramount Records itself could have just been erased off the face of the earth.
Well, and all of this is the backstory, the unlikely backstory behind why you decided to take up scuba diving.
Yes, this is one thing I really never thought that this book would would require of me. But I had heard the story from several people about, you know, this sort of day of reckoning when disgruntled Paramount employees were just hurling records into the river, and that was what had happened to all of the 78s. And so I'd heard it repeated a few times. I thought, God, well, that's really interesting. And then I heard about a TV show called The History Detectives, which is a PBS television show, and somebody told me that they had recorded an episode where they had sent a team to scuba dive in the Milwaukee River, and they hadn't found anything, but they also sort of hadn't given up hope that it could be there. And that was just enough for me to think, okay, well, that's what I have to do. If I really want to be serious about this, if I want to find these records, if I want to kind of secure a place in this community, here's a way to try to do it. Here's a thing I can do. I can go to, I can fly to Milwaukee and drive up to Grafton and get in the river and see what I can find.
And how did it go?
Well, I will say the whole time I was doing it, other collectors and everybody I met along the way kept saying, well, this is insane. Of course, you're not going to find anything. This was, almost 100 years ago. And they were right. We did find some old kind of rusty machinery, some bits that we presume, and we later verified, were likely part of the pressing plant, which had since been raised. We didn't find any records or any metal masters. So, alas, unfortunately, the search continues for some of the very coveted and rare existing Paramount records.
It is a Paramount title that remains the holy grail for at least one of the collectors you profile, a record called Devil Got My Woman by Skip James. Who was Skip James, and what makes this record so remarkable?
Well, one of the reasons that record is so remarkable is that it's incredibly rare. I think there are maybe 2 to 3 extant copies, 2 to 3 known copies of that record remaining. It's great. There's a movie directed by Terry Zwigoff himself, a 78 collector, called Ghost World. It's starring Steve Buscemi, and there's a moment in that movie where Steve Buscemi plays Devil Got My Woman. He plays a 78 of Devil Got My Woman for a young character named Enid, who's played by Thora Birch. And at the end of the scene, and I always think this sums up the appeal of that song so well, at the end of the scene, she says, I want to hear another song like that. Like, I want to hear more records like that. And he just looks at her and sort of pauses for a second and says, there aren't any more records like that. And Devil Got My Woman is this beautiful, sort of strange, meandering, and almost structureless blues song sung by a man named Skip James, who was a blues singer, an American blues singer from Mississippi. And it's just, I'm excited that we'll get to play a little bit of it for your listeners because it's just an incredibly haunting and strange performance. Skip James has this sort of high, spectral yowl almost. I don't even know how else to describe his voice. And it's the kind of song that I think you hear once and it just, replays itself for you over and over again. And every time you listen to it, you sort of hear something else. But certainly a cry of a certain kind of yearning, a certain kind of despair, a certain kind of pain that I think Skip James sort of enunciates like no one else I've ever heard sing.
There is kind of an irony in some of this music, of course, that these musicians probably didn't imagine they were turning out songs that would be thought of in these terms 75 years later, even thought of at all.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't imagine that they would have. I think had you sat Skip James down and, 1931 and said, listen, 75 years later, people are going to be going bonkers trying to find, get their hands on these records, he would have laughed, had a very long, loud laugh.
Right. This is like the Native Americans who thought they were just making, pots and plates. And, centuries later, these are, finds that are unearthed and thought of as antiquities.
Absolutely. I mean, and it was the dawn of the recording industry, too. I think people, in the 20s, certainly, people still thought of music, just music in general, was a thing you heard live. I mean, the thought of taking home a disc and recreating a performance in your parlor using this kind of odd big machine, it was still, a very new idea. So that's the thing you hear on these records, too. And 78 collectors will often kind of gripe about contemporary music and all of the things that they think are lacking in contemporary music. And I, for the most part, am sort of skeptical of that way of thinking. I'm a big pop music fan. I like a lot of modern and contemporary music. But there is something about the way that these performers sang, the way that they performed in the studio, that there is a certain unself-consciousness that I think we've all lost now, because now people are very aware that they're making an artifact, they're making a recording, they're making something that's going to endure. And it was really different then. When somebody came into a recording studio and played a song, you know, they were recorded live, they were recorded in one take, and I don't think you felt the weight of, oh, I'm making a record. It was just going to play this song and, you know, knows what will happen.
Most of the people who read this book will probably never start sifting through thrift shops and antique stores in a quest like this. But what do you think people who think of themselves as music lovers can get out of appreciating your interest and the efforts of some of these extremely dedicated collectors?
I mean, I think we all now think of music because of the accessibility that we have to music, all kinds of music. It's sort of instantly available to us. I think it's really easy to forget that there was a time when that wasn't possible, when that wasn't true, and that these songs, the work that collectors do in terms of preserving and researching this music, how important that is to our understanding of, you know, American culture and certainly of American music. And if they weren't doing that work, there would be so, you know, I mean, you look at a band like the Rolling Stones or Led Zeppelin or any of the sort of great rock bands of the 60s, and you look at where they were pulling their influences from. You know, it was Robert Johnson, it was guys like that, Delta Blues singers, and we only have those records, we only have that story because collectors bothered to find and preserve and digitize and you know, perpetuate that music. And that, to me, is a sort of great untold American story. And collectors themselves are, you know, they're quirky individuals, they sort of operate by their own rules, they're often working kind of outside of mainstream circles, they're, you know, often feel sort of marginalized and uncool, but the work that they did has had such extraordinary ramifications for all of us. And that was another real pleasure for me in writing this book, was getting to tell that story.
Well, Amanda Petrusich, it's a great story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
Amanda Petrusich's recent book is called Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. She spoke with us by phone from New York, where she teaches at New York University. That's all for the Tuesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Hope you can tune in tomorrow. We'll have a conversation with LeVar Burton, the host of the long-running PBS Kids series Reading Rainbow. We'll talk about his role as a leading reading advocate in this country. That's tomorrow at 10 o'clock on Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee. Right now it's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.